So as I was wanting to say, or as I was saying, I want to follow up once again on Zhajie's teachings of Friday night in Yakima of now a month ago. And he had come back from the Kala Chakra teachings that His Holiness was giving in India, and he was so energized. It was quite amazing. I'll see if I can get the video recording of his talk at some point, and maybe we can look at it when, you know, the opportunity seems good. But one of his themes was going back to basics, and so in a certain sense, that's kind of what I'd like to do, is go back to some basics. And his way of going back to the basics was to be completely comprehensive about everything. So I'm going to attempt that. I'm not sure I'm going to succeed, but we'll see how it goes. So to literally start with the basics, when the Buddha first was teaching, we know that one of the things he taught about was the five aggregates of existence, of personal existence. And what this was about was his very practical analytic view on what is a human being, and on the basis of understanding what is a human being, then he taught what is it about the way we live that isn't working for us, and what can we do about it so that it starts to work for us, which is to say, we're not really satisfied with our lives. How can we become satisfied? And from my point of view, I think the best way to say it is, how can we find peace? That's the way I would phrase it. The Dalai Lama says, everyone wants to be happy. Nobody wants to be unhappy. And so that's the way he begins his discourses. Everyone wants to be happy. It's your birthright to be happy, but there's something going on that's preventing you from being happy. What is it? Let's deal with that. Happiness always sounds good, but when I reflect on what I've really cared about in my life and what I found a distinct lack of is peace. And world peace is nice, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about inner peace. And I suppose if everybody found inner peace, there would be world peace, but so I'll start with me. Anyhow, so what is it what is it about the way we exist that seems to be a problem? So the way that the Buddha taught about that was that if you look at your experience, you'll find that you can kind of look at your experience analytically, and you'll see that everything falls into one of five categories, which he called aggregates. And the way he taught was he would say, look, let's look at our experience, and we know that one thing about our experience is that there's something physical, material going on, material body, material world, and that's not reducible to really anything else, that materiality exists. And he'd say, so here's a stone, and that represents materiality. And he said, and then the other thing we can notice about our experience is that no matter what's going on in our experience, we either like what it is, or we don't like what it is, or we're neutral about what it is. And that there is no fourth possibility. I mean, we're either attracted to something because we like it, and we're afraid of losing it, by the way, or we're repelled by something because we don't like it and we're perfectly happy for it to go away and fearful that it'll come back, or we don't care about it. But you can't come up with a fourth, that those things, that's all-encompassing. He said, so here's three stones for that category. Now we got two categories. There's this one stone over here and three stones over there. Said, now then, having said all of that, if you think about it, though, what you realize is that your experience of material things comes through your sense organs. That's the way you know things. So he said, so here's another category, because your sense organs may be material, but the way they operate and the way they function for you is different than, say, the materiality of a table. So we make this a special category, aggregate or skanda in Sanskrit. And he said, so he puts one stone down, that's for all the stuff that we see. He puts another stone down, that's all the stuff we hear. He puts another stone down, that's for all the stuff we can touch. Another stone for all the stuff we can smell. Another stone for all the stuff we can taste. And then he puts a sixth stone down, and that's for all the stuff that we can think. Because the way the Buddha taught was that thoughts, and thoughts is a broad category in itself. It doesn't just mean verbal thoughts. It means something broader than that, and which I won't get into right now. He puts the sixth stone down. He said, thoughts are something that we perceive. So then, of course, we're all going to ask, okay, I know that when I see something, my eye sees it. When I hear something, my ear hears it. So what is the organ of perception of thought? Even in the Buddha's time, this is a question. The organ of perception of thought is what we call mind. Okay, so what is that? So we'll come back to what that is. We'll bracket it for a minute. There's this organ of thought perception called mind. And he said, okay, now then there's something else that we notice is that everything that goes on for us is sort of a matter of habit. There is something which in our modern language we would call habit. It's not quite what he called it, but nevertheless, there are these habits that we have, and habits aren't really reducible to anything else, and they really seem to be in charge of what we perceive through our six sense organs. And as a result of habits, we also have a certain kind of body because we've lived a certain kind of way. And as a result of habits, we're attracted to some things and we're repelled by other things. So habit and being attracted and being repelled, however, are two different things, right? Because there's the feeling of being attracted to something, and there's the underlying thing which makes you attracted to it. So he drew a distinction between those. So this analysis is now starting to get pretty sophisticated. So here's a pebble for this kind of habit, and here's a pebble for another kind of habit. And that pile got really big because there are a lot of different kind of habits. So we won't go into how many there are, but it was a big pile, okay? Because all these are different kinds of habits. There are habits of perception. There's habits of emotion, which are a bit different. There's habits of thinking, and so on and so forth. And then he said, and then, you know, the other thing is that you're aware of things. What we would call consciousness is something that's involved in this process also. And he put a stone down. He said, but consciousness is only consciousness. There are no two kinds of consciousness. Now, that sounds a little bit strange because we just talked about six kinds of perception. And so there's consciousness through the different six different kinds of perception, because you can't have perception without consciousness. But what he was saying is that every kind of perception that you have is consciousness with a sense organ and an object of that sense organ. But the consciousness itself through the different six sense organs are no different. So the essence of visual consciousness is no different than the essence of auditory consciousness. What's different is the sense organ that consciousness is connected with. Therefore, sound consciousness seems different than visual consciousness. And perhaps most importantly, therefore, thinking consciousness seems different than every other kind of consciousness. And it is a unique kind of problem. Because the way we're aware of thoughts is particularly subtle and complicated. Because mostly we don't notice ourselves passively being aware of thoughts. What we notice is, I am thinking, that is me doing this, and we are completely identified with the thoughts. Now, there are people who, in very sophisticated experience of sports, will report the experience of being in the zone or the flow, where they feel like they're unselfconscious. You know? When that happens, it's like their consciousness is totally into that particular sense experience. But that's really the way most people are, from my point of view, in relationship to thought, because we're totally into it to the point where we don't recognize anything other than I am it, I am doing it, I am thinking it. And therefore we believe it all because it's me. When I'm thinking that I have to do something, right? Like I have to get on the discussion board in my online class, right? And I'm thinking this very strongly, it's kind of like, that's me. That's it. I mean, that I'm totally involved in that and all the fantasies that are going with it and are running with it. Like, oh, I'm too tired. I don't want to deal with it. Or, wow, what kind of cool stuff have the students been saying? Or, gee whiz, I better really, you know, get on the discussion board and be serious about the students because this term the university is evaluating my performance and there's the consequences and I'll go, you know. And then my mind is totally wrapped up in all of this stuff and there's no separation between the parts anymore. I'm lost in it. Now, you know, when an athlete is lost in the zone, it's good. Athletes like that. It feels good. But when we're lost in the zone of our thoughts, it's not so good because they're running us. And how are they running us? Now, Zhajie said something that has totally fascinated me. Usually when habits are described by most scholars, by most Buddhist teachers, the term that's used in Sanskrit is samskara. And the way that that is usually defined in English is something like karmic formation, which is to say that the history of our experience causes us to have certain habits. It's like the more you smoke cigarettes, the more you're going to smoke cigarettes, the less you smoke cigarettes, the less you're going to smoke cigarettes. That's the way habits work. Okay. And in Buddhist English translations, that's usually called a karmic formation. In other words, your karma, which is to say the history of your habits, forms something about your behavior. Zhajie has been translating that as energy for quite a long time. And I've never heard anybody use that language, energy. So I've been thinking, what is this about energy? What does he mean by energy? And, you know, I can't say that I know for sure why he's picked this particular language, but what I've noticed is if you think about the way your habits run you, it's like you're flowing with them. It's like they have an energy and they carry you along. So I think that that's what he was getting at, is that the habits, the karmic formations and samskaras, and he calls them energy, really are, it's like the energy of your existence is constantly shaped by the history of your existence, which is your habits. And that's really what runs us. And that's what runs our thought forms when we're lost in our thought forms. So that's, you know, now if you start thinking about that, that's pretty profound. Now, the Buddha taught all of this, and you'll notice that in all of this, there's no thing which we will call an I or a me, right? So, you know, what is that all about? Well, what he said was, I is a thought that's used to hold together, or a label or a name that's used to hold together all of these experiences. And you say, these experiences are happening to me. He said, but if you really look at the experiences, what you find is that I is just a thought floating in relationship to all these experiences. And if you look really closely in meditation, for example, you can separate I from the experiences. And here's a really easy way to do it. If you think about an experience and you think, I'm having this thought, I'm having this experience, one of the things that you'll notice is then that I, the experience, and your awareness of it are completely different things. Okay? And that you are aware or conscious of I, which means consciousness and I have to be two different things. They can't be the same thing, right? If you're aware of conscious and you're aware of I, then awareness, I, conscious, these things can't be the same. So the notion then is that I is just another part of experience, but not necessarily the experiencer, because the experiencer is consciousness. And what is experienced is I. And the I that's experienced is a label for that whole complex of things coming together. So in Buddhist terminology, that's the emptiness of self, right? Because there is something there, but it's not what it appears to be, right? There is something there, but it is not a solid something. It's merely a label that's attached to all that kind of stuff, okay? So that was the first level of the Buddhist teaching. And the reason for this way of teaching was that if you begin to understand this way of analyzing your experience, then you can sort of step back from, if you will, to be metaphoric, you can step back from being driven by the energy or the habit patterns that generally carry you into whatever situation they carry you into. So it doesn't mean that you can't smoke a cigarette if you want to smoke a cigarette. It just means that you can notice what's going on and you have a choice about whether or not you're going to smoke a cigarette. Or in my case, whether or not I'm going to have toast for breakfast along with my eggs and my hash browns because I'm on a diet. So, no, I'm going to have broccoli instead. You know, this becomes a matter of choice rather than a matter of compulsion. And that's really what the Buddhist teaching was about, giving you choice rather than compulsion. Because then you can choose to do the things that are going to bring you happiness or peace rather than choosing, rather than being driven to do the things that don't bring you peace. And we know the worst examples of these things because we call them addictions. Right? And addictions are big problems. So it's not that the Buddha said this is the way we solve the addiction problem, but we know what addictions are. We know what the opposite of addictions are. Addictions opposite are freedom, choice. You know, it's like you can smoke the cigarette or not. That's up to you. Rather than, I haven't had a cigarette for half an hour. I've got to have a cigarette. Those are very different kinds of experiences. Okay. Now, later Buddhist teaching looked at all of this and observed that this idea that there was nothing solid to a person, that you had all these parts that functioned in this complex process, right? That actually this way of looking at the person was very powerful. And in fact, you could look at all those little rocks that the Buddha put down on the ground and look at every one of them, or what they represented anyhow, what they labeled, what they identified, and perform the same analysis, right? So that you can look at the material world, for example, which was one rock, and if you look at it really closely, you find that it's made up of parts. I mean, it's not just a solid thing, right? I mean, obviously there are parts like, you know, streets, trees, houses. Well, but those are parts, you know, foundation, stone, timber, linoleum, asphalt, roof, all this kind of stuff. But if you look at those things, you find that they can be broken down into parts too. You know, I mean, you look at the foundation, it's concrete. What is concrete? It's sand, and go through, I don't know what everything is that's in concrete. You know, but there's all this stuff that's there. You can break it down to atoms, and then the atoms can be broken down to whatever, you know, neutrinos and whatnot. And those things apparently, in many cases, can be broken down. They don't seem to find an end to this process. Now, if you perform that kind of analysis on every one of the stones, what happens? Well, then things start getting really interesting. Now, we don't have the time to do that for all of these different things, but if we look at the one stone of consciousness, and we think about that, and we perform the analysis on consciousness, then it does get really interesting. And I remember the Dalai Lama saying that if you meditate on the emptiness of your own consciousness, and that's what this is, to perform this kind of analysis on your consciousness, then you get the most, how did he phrase it? You make real progress. Now, that wasn't quite the way he phrased it, but it's where you really get progress in the path to liberation or enlightenment or freedom or having choice, is when you really look at consciousness, the nature of consciousness, and you start seeing it as empty. And so how can consciousness be empty? Right? So the way consciousness is empty is if you, we will do this later tonight, but you can also do this on your own. If you look at consciousness, the immediate way in which you react to your own subjective awareness is it's unchanging, solid, consistent, persistent, independent, not made of parts, unchanging. Now you can notice this. If you look at your own awareness, when you first think about your own awareness, your own consciousness, it just seems like that. There it is. But when you look at it really closely, and so that gets tricky, right? Because now this is awareness trying to look at awareness, right? You start noticing that that's not exactly the way it is. Now this takes a lot of effort. But what the Buddhist teaching about this is that consciousness is something which has a continuity over time, and yet is constantly changing. For one thing, it's always connected up with a different sense organ. But for another thing, I mean, in the 24-hour cycle, we have at least three distinct forms of consciousness, right? We have waking consciousness. We have deep sleep, not aware of anything consciousness, or as Buddhists would actually say, aware of nothing. They don't see it as non-awareness. They see it as awareness of nothing because the senses aren't functioning, but it doesn't mean awareness is gone. This is a different point of view from the Western. And then we have dreaming consciousness. So we know there's at least those three distinct forms of consciousness. And actually, we know that they can relate to each other in a funny way because we can talk about having daydreams, right? And daydream is what? It's like a waking dream of a certain type. And there are people who have lucid dreams, which is their consciousness within the context of actually having a dream, you know, and they can do interesting, very interesting things while they're dreaming. I know a man who can dream lucidly, and he has an incredibly successful automobile business. He solves very interesting problems when he's dreaming, you know. And it's been very lucrative for him to be able to do that. And he's also a totally sweet, wonderful person. And you would think that anybody that could be conscious in their dreams, have lucid dreams, would be a non-ordinary person. He's a non-ordinary person. I would buy a car from him, used or otherwise. And if we really think about it, actually we'll notice that waking consciousness has a lot of different characteristics too. You know, I mean, we have concentrated consciousness, we have dispersed consciousness. These things are really very different than each other. We're capable of focusing our consciousness, concentrating our attention, which is a very different kind of consciousness than the usual walk down the street, go to work, you know, smell the flowers, worry about what's happening next kind of consciousness. And so there are different kinds of things that are going on. So if you notice it, if you start looking at it, you'll see that even though it has a continuity, it's always changing. Now, the way Buddhists usually talk about this, they talk about this as many different consciousnesses. We might say moments of consciousness or states of mind, but they actually don't say that. They say something like different minds or different consciousnesses because they are so radically different from each other. And yet all these different ones have a continuity. Now, in the Buddhist analysis, when you look at this, though, what it means is that it's not, and this is tricky, it means it is not permanent. It is not consistent. It is not singular in the sense of that which is unchanging. In fact, it's constantly changing. But we think of it as being the same in all of those moments. That doesn't mean it really is. And there's something mysterious in there as to whether it is or isn't. Or maybe it both is and isn't. Now, the Buddha taught the middle way. That's what he was known to teach, the middle way, which is to say, it's not that it is, and it's not that it isn't. It's not that it is this one thing, but it's not that it isn't this one thing. Now, if you can apply that way of understanding to your own consciousness, then what you get is flow. Then what you get is peace, because then there's no struggling going on, right? Because whatever's going on in your consciousness, you're just noticing, well, here is my consciousness changing. Now it's this, now it's that, now it's the other thing. You don't have the expectation that it's just one thing. You don't have the expectation that it has one shape or one form or one dynamic characteristic, or that it's happy or that it's unhappy or that it's anything. In fact, all of that stuff through all of the five skandhas is all just this great big churning flow of impermanent, constantly changing experience. And it's actually never going to be anything else. How it could be anything else? How could it be anything else? That's all it ever could be. So if you can get into the space of noticing that and hanging out with that, then you're into a certain kind of flow. And that's peace, because there's no struggling going on. Except the struggle is part of experience. So you can be peaceful within the context of struggle, because struggle is just something that's happening. It's like, okay, there's struggle, right? It's like, okay, there's happiness. Like, okay, there's peace. Oh, okay. There's my boss is yelling at me. That happens. Well, not necessarily yelling, but unhappy, you know. There's, oh, my wife is giving me a big hug. Isn't that sweet? I mean, there's just all this, and it's just like, and it's just flowing. When you're into that space where it's all just flowing, and you're just there in that space of it's all just flowing, you don't see it as solid, you don't see it as existing, you don't see it as non-existing, because these are the two, you know, tricky elements of things. It's like, it's just solid and it's exactly what it is. That's not true. Okay, and then the first thing that you'll think is, oh, that means it doesn't exist at all. And these are the big dichotomies that our minds fall into. That's not it either. It does exist. It just doesn't exist as permanent. It doesn't exist as what you think it is. It's constantly flowing and changing. It's made up of parts. All of it. Everything. It's just this huge, energetic, flowing mass of experience. And if you're not stuck on any part of it, then it just flows on. And the space that exists is what's then called the sky-like mind. Because it just holds and incorporates everything, and everything is just moving through it. And it's another kind of real peacefulness. It's sort of like the, okay, this is going to sound dichotomously weird, but sort of like, I am the space that all this stuff is happening in, except that I is something that's happening within the space. So, but there's no other way to talk about this. That spaciousness is actually what you are. And then all of this stuff of experience is just flowing within it. And it's not a matter of accepting or rejecting any specific part of it. It's not a matter of saying, yes, this is to be accepted, this is to be rejected. I mean, in a moral and ethical way, you could say that. In a, this is a good habit, this is a bad habit way, you could say that. But this is a different way of saying there's nothing to be grasped or non-grasped, be accepted or rejected, because all this stuff is just happening within it. It's not saying morality is irrelevant or ethics is irrelevant. It's a way of saying that whether you succeed in being ethical or fail in being ethical, it's still happening within the space of the sky-like mind. And there's a space behind that that incorporates all of that. So that doesn't make, in a certain sense, what I'm describing doesn't make any sense. Why is that? It's because mind and thinking and all this stuff, consciousness, I, and everything else, is held within that space. The space holds it. So how could it grasp and explain and understand and communicate the space which holds it? In fact, space is only a metaphor for that which is going on, that this is happening within. Another metaphor for it is Buddha mind, Buddha nature, enlightenment, liberation, realization, sky-like mind, reality, that which is beyond is and isn't. Tao, God. I don't know about that stuff, but that's probably it too. So that's what Rinpoche was talking about through my language, and his was much more eloquent, but it's sort of like that's the comprehensive whole thing. And so we'll practice some of this a little bit after pumpkin pie and other nice things. Okay. So let's, questions, you know, we have a little time for questions. If not, we can go for the snacks.
So we talk about the collective unconsciousness.
Yes, what about the collective unconscious?
I'm asking you, where does it fit in?
Collective unconscious, you're talking in strictly in a Jungian sense because of this thing with the class.
Yeah,
that
which is, yeah, that could be it. Can you, yes.
Yeah, well, not a Buddhist concept.
Okay.
But there, Buddhists can. There is a Buddhist way of thinking about what Carl Jung was talking about when he talked about the collective unconscious. So that would be that we all have habits that we are not aware of. There's a technical way in Buddhism to talk about those habits that are so deep within us and the way in which we cognize that we're not aware of how they work, but they are there. Okay, there are, it's probably similar to what Immanuel Kant referred to as, I forgot the language, how did he refer to it? He had a way of talking about patterns or archetypes that were very deeply ingrained and controlled the way we understood things. I can't remember the technical term he used anymore. But, so we all have those things. And those things, collectively, where we all have that kind of similarity, mm-hmm. would probably be like the Jungian collective unconscious. For example, instincts are included in the collective unconscious. Mm-hmm. And we all have the instinct to want to live, for example. Or most of us have the instinct to want to reproduce. Some of us don't happen to have that instinct, but most people have that instinct to reproduce. What other kinds of instincts do we have? I don't know, you can go down the list. I mean, if you're Freudian, there are all kinds of instincts for aggression, sexuality, and whatnot. What Jung, I think, was getting at was more the deep levels of habitual patterns that control the way in which we perceive things. And in that sense, there is something similar to the Buddhist idea of the karmic formations or the energy that Zajie talked about. And there are patterns that we all share. You know, like we all construct the world similarly. If we didn't all construct our experience of the world similarly, we wouldn't be able to share our experience and communicate and be here together. So there's something deep about that. And I think that the linguists in the 21st century have been working with that. Those deep levels of patterning, which control the way language works, which therefore controls the way in which we put together our understanding of the world that we're living in. I think that would be similar to Jung's collective unconscious. Best I can do.
It's called an unconscious compared to conscious.
Well, unconscious, yeah, but see, then unconscious simply means that which you're not conscious of.
Yeah.
Yet. Yet. Right. And that is the operative term, yet. Yeah. Because even in the Jungian sense, you can become conscious of a lot of it, but not all of it.
Right.
But in the Buddhist sense, you could actually become conscious of all of it. For example, in the dying process, if you're very aware of what's going on, you watch the mind, I better get technical here. You watch the habits of conscious thought fall away. Certain types of habits of conscious thought fall away. Sort of like there's certain ways in which we construct our experience, and if you're really sophisticated, as you're dying, you can see there's that habit pattern, and it all falls away. And here's another habit pattern that is running the way reality is constructed now. It's falling away. I can't talk about this with any real sophistication or detail because I can't say that I understand it very much. It's really far beyond me to understand. But there are teachings about that, and one can find good books on the subject, but I can't really talk about it. But the point is that it's unconscious to us now, but it doesn't have to stay unconscious.
Thanks.
No more questions.
That makes the difference between unconsciousness and ignorance?
Well, ignorance is a technical Buddhist term, but I'm not sure that that's the way you're wanting to use it. When you say ignorance, tell me more what you mean.
Those are two different things.
Ignorance and unconsciousness?
Yeah.
Tell me what you mean by ignorance.
Ignorance is an inability to, or a lack of desire to pursue, or know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, okay.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, see, there's the technical Buddhist term, ignorance, means grasping at selfhood where there is not selfhood. And I wanted to be sure that that's not what you meant. Mm-hmm. You mean ignorance in the sense of, I don't know and I don't care and I don't want to know. You know, I worked hard all day, give me a beer and let me watch TV, ignorance. That's, well, you know, I mean, that's, I'm not knocking it, believe me. There are plenty of times I come home and my view is, You know, give me a large glass of wine and let me turn on the TV and that's it. I'm checking out for a while. So I'm not saying that this is, you know, there's a time for everything and I have those times.
You like being ignorant for a little while.
Very much so. It's sometimes
an unconscious choice.
Yeah, it could be. But you're talking about something else, which is people who really don't want to know and prefer not to know. And, you know, I think that that's most of the human race. They don't, you know, and that's just the way it is. I mean, everybody in this room is a little unusual in the sense that
that's
we're...
That's for sure.
But, I mean, in this...
It's very difficult to try to be conscious.
It's very.
It's painful. Yeah.
Yes.
Painful. When I told April earlier, I just had a really painful experience of being conscious of... my thoughts and my actions, mm-hmm. and
yes, yeah, but for most of us, there's a certain point where ongoing, nonstop, can't cope with it.
I was in the zone of this.
What?
Mm-hmm. It was a matter of being in the zone of my thoughts, body, the reaction.
Yeah.
Habit.
Well, ignorance is a habit.
Yeah, but, yeah, and it is easier to just forget about that stuff and let it go than to look at it and be with it and say, okay, what's going to come out of this? I mean, I don't know if you recall about 2 months ago, you know, I came here to do a talk and I said, I don't think I can do this because I had just had, I don't know what happened to you, but I had one of those things where it's like, okay, David, today you're less than a human being. You just let some anger so take over, you know, that how could this be? And now what? You're gonna do a talk on Buddhism this evening? Hypocrite. You know, and it was kind of like, well, yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, okay. And yes, it's easier to just, but for us, too late. So we're going to have to cope with it. And that's all I'll say about it.
I talk to my students a lot about how the mind can lie, but the body rarely does, and that a lot of times you're shaking your head and saying, yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, I know.
Or, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because your body and
yeah.
is... saying what it really feels,
yeah.
you know, like, you know, when you cross your arms with somebody that you're friendly with and you haven't done that before, that means that your body is trying to be honest with that human, but you've been taught to be nice, you've been taught to, you know, fight for your rights, you've been taught to close off when certain stimuli enter, you've been taught, and you also are instinctive, so while your mind is saying, oh, this is fine, you know, talking to this person, and your instincts are saying, go away from this person, this is not a good person, go away from them, they are not good for you, but you're taught to be, oh, be nice, they're just asking for directions, you know, and then, you know, they take your car keys or something. And so, in terms of consciousness, in terms of Buddhist consciousness, do you think that the body is more aware sometimes than the mind is in terms of Buddhist precept? I mean, in terms of that
truth.
Truth.
I think that's. You know? I think you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And that's why yoga is so good for us, and that's why, you know, Qigong is so good for us, and
right.
Things that we can do bodily that are also spiritual, even massage, I've found that sometimes, you know, where you are trying to hold everything together and then someone massages you and you're just like, wah!
Yeah.
Because your body knows truth and that the highest self can kind of be achieved through the working of the unconscious and the body together. And that's what meditation is for me, I guess if I try to explain to somebody, it's like your body is working with your consciousness to keep the mind away a little bit. Because the mind will say, get up, get some food, you know, read this new magazine you got today, where, you know, your body is working with your inner self to say, stay. Wait.
Yeah.
Let some time happen. So, I mean, I think it's fascinating from a nonverbal sort of viewpoint about what we do in terms of what's happening in here, you know, and then what's happening in here, and then what this likes to do.
There is a whole category of Buddhist practice called mindfulness practice, which we haven't talked about very much here. But it's about watching what your body is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of mindfulness practice is taught so that people will become aware of maybe things that are not so wholesome. But here you're talking about what I think is a kind of mindfulness practice where your body knows a truth that your mind is telling you a different story. And if you've practiced mindfulness of your body, you notice that your body is telling you something. And you can learn a truth because your body knows that truth where your mind is confused. And so that is a way of seeing truth by the body showing you truth. And there are a lot of Zen practices about this, by the way. So that's one thing. And there was something else I was going to say about this, but I forgot what it was. But I'm in complete agreement with you. If I'm talking with somebody and I notice I'm getting tight, that I'm grasping my hands, for example, or that my breathing has changed and it's become constrained, then I know that something's not good going on here. And it might not be about them, it might be about me. I mean, it becomes a little more difficult at that point to say, what is this really about? And you have to start paying real close attention. But your body will sometimes tell you these things where your mind is just like, oh yeah, I'm having one of those, you know, work experiences, social experiences
with
a colleague.
Well, that's where judgment comes in. You know? Yeah. Again, that's mine. So, you know, you're trusting your body. It could be about them, it could be about you. It doesn't really matter.
But something's not
but
right.
Something's not mm-hmm. right or something.
Right.
One right. time I was walking home from school, and it was late at night when I was in graduate school in Jersey, and it was really dangerous where we lived, got like projects. So I always carried a mat knife in my pocket, and people were always getting grabbed, and I got grabbed twice. And it was just, you know, it was like the mid-80s, and you were mm-hmm. in Jersey. And so one time I was coming down a stairwell, and I stopped at the like middle of the stairs, and then you go in through the stairwell, and then you went out. And I was just like, no. And I turned around and went the other way, and I found out that there was a rape the night before in that stairwell.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And that I just knew that, not that, you know, maybe that I wouldn't be in trouble, but I knew that that was a place of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, how we know when someone is standing behind us.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, there's a lot of things that are conscious and unconscious, and our body work out together,
mm-hmm.
that if we could just be so much more aware of that
mm-hmm.
walk, you know, I think that mindfulness, you know, tons of books on mindfulness, you read them, you think about them. But really, if you just listen to your body and you listen to what's inside yourself, it just seems like your walk is so much easier
mm-hmm.
in this world.
Yeah, I was just remembering what it was that I had forgotten that I wanted to share with you all, and it's about potato chips, of all weird things. There's a Zen teacher by the name of Ed Brown, who's mostly known for the way he teaches about cooking. He was one of the founding cooks in San Francisco Zen Center, and he's gone on to do a lot of workshops and teaching about cooking. As a matter of fact, you can rent a Netflix in which he's in Germany teaching Germans about conscious cookery, Zen cookery. It's pretty interesting. He has an exercise. So that's the reason for mentioning his name, because I'm going to share with you his exercise. He invented this thing. He said, you know, potato chips. Most people who get into potato chips is like, you know, one after another. Like, you know, the old advertisement, you can't eat just one. He said, okay, well, now let's try this. Take a potato chip and put it in your mouth and let it melt and really pay attention to this. And then do another one. And then maybe do another one. He said, you won't eat very many potato chips before you say to yourself, this is disgusting. But on the other hand, if you don't pay attention and you just scarf them and let them go, and I do this all the time myself, I'm not innocent of this. It's like you go through a whole bag.
Yeah.
It's really easy. But if you ever really stop and pay attention, serious attention, your body will say, yuck! Because your body knows the truth about potato chips. However, my body never tells me that about chocolate.
Last night I got this thing and I still wanted more.
Okay. Why don't we take a snack break? Okay.
Yes.
Speaking of food. Oh, but the food out there, that's different. There are no potato chips out there.